The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Port Aransas sits at the northernmost tip of Mustang Island, a long and narrow stretch of land that, along with a few other islands, provides about a 250-mile outline of Texas from the tip of the state up in the Gulf of Mexico. Mustang Island itself is around 18 miles long, and the barrier island housed an active fort during the Mexican War in the late 1840s. To protect the entrance into Aransas Bay. The fort also served the Confederacy during the Civil War, and although the Southern troops maintained control of Mustang Island into 1863, the Union would, of course, push the Confederacy out and seize control, a major blow to the South's ability to supply Confederate soldiers fighting in their northernmost states and in Union territory with food and other necessary supplies. The 20th century, though, would have the island and its inhabitants see brighter times as Aransas and Corpus Christi bays became major ports of entry for importing and exporting. Mustang Island became something of a tourist haven, too. The winters on Mustang Island were warm, and deep-sea fishermen, swimmers, and beachgoers began flocking to the island as quickly as ferries that transported automobiles to and from could be built. It became a popular place for the summer homes of the middle and upper classes, whether owned or rented. Though a large military presence re-emerged on the island during World War II, mostly precautionary, the 500 or so individuals who resided on the island remained, and Mustang Island saw no incident, of course, in the war. Tourism also continued, but a Navy bombing range would stick around for another decade or so. After the war, and presumably in direct relation to the island's booming tourism, the illegal vice industry in Texas skyrocketed, as it had in practically every corner of the United States at that time, and Port Aransas became a popular place to go for illicitness. Gambling, strip joints, and prostitution, in fact, were prevalent all over Mustang Island at that time, though law enforcement seemed to have turned a blind eye to the activity for the most part. 1961's Hurricane Carla wiped out a majority of these establishments, and for some unexplained reason, much of this activity ceased to exist. Perhaps the booming oil industry and the upper crust dwellers that it brought to the island played a role, and by 1969, many of these dwellers owned second homes there. Green and Genevieve Duncan were certainly among the upper crust who owned a vacation home on Mustang Island near the Port Aransas Marina, just off the Corpus Christi Port Aransas Channel. Green Cameron Duncan was a prominent cattleman in South Texas and vice president of Likes Brothers Incorporated of San Antonio, the large and lucrative cattle and shipping company of his wife Genevieve's namesake. Genevieve's family, in fact, has ties to the 14th governor of Florida, as well as the 34th Florida Supreme Court Justice. The family was vacationing at their home in Port Aransas in July of 1969, and a week after they arrived from San Antonio, Green and Genevieve's 14-year-old daughter, May, was expecting her friend to join her on holiday there. Caroline Louise Hart, also 14 years old, arrived to spend the next 5 days with May on Saturday, July 19, 1969. Caroline was born in Des Moines, Iowa, but had moved to San Antonio with her mother and father in 1963. Caroline's parents, Houston Harriman Hart Jr. and Carolyn Esther Hart, were also affluent and prominent. Her grandfather, Houston H. Hart Sr., was president of Hart Hanks Publishing, which owned 13 newspapers across the state of Texas, including the San Antonio Express and the Corpus Christi Caller-Times. Her father was the publisher of the former, her uncle Edward, the publisher of the latter. They too owned a vacation home, but in Rockport, in Key Allegro and Aransas Bay, about 10 or so miles from Port Aransas by boat. She attended St. Mary's Hall Private School in San Antonio, where she met May, and the two girls had just completed the 8th grade. Though the girls had little direct contact with tourists or residents that week, many recalled the girls having a good time cruising around in the Duncan family's red beach buggy with May's parents. The few folks who did run into the girls remarked that they were well-mannered and kind. Caroline and May's holiday together was uneventful. Little else but what can be expected from a vacation on the beach occurred for the first several days. The only thing out of the ordinary was the girls' bathing suits being stolen off the line at the house as they hung out to dry. The early morning hours of the 5th day, however, would prove to be anything but ordinary. They would prove to be unimaginable and terrifying, in fact. A little after 11 p.m. on Wednesday, July 23rd, 1969, Caroline and May's eyelids became heavy as they laid in their separate twin beds, reading aloud the novel, How Green Was My Valley. Caroline laid the book on the nightstand and turned off the lights, and the two girls fell asleep. The room in which they slept was a small bedroom and the only room on the bottom story. Besides this room and a small garage, the remainder of the bottom story was open air, with only support beams taking up any space. The home's main floor, like most beach houses on the Texas coast, was up the stairs on the second level. The room where Caroline and May slept was only accessible from the outside. At about 2:30 a.m., now the early morning hours of Thursday, July 24th, May's father awoke to the sound of a slamming screen door and voices from outside the beach house. Mr. Duncan quickly put on a pair of shorts and headed outside to investigate. He didn't turn on any lights as to not alert any potential prowlers, and he suspected a thief since the girls' bathing suits had been stolen off the line a few days before, but he didn't see anyone or anything unusual. Mr. Duncan glanced at the lower floor bedroom where the girls slept, saw that no lights were on, and returned upstairs to his room. Awakened by her husband returning to the room, Genevieve Duncan decided to further investigate. She slid on her robe, exited into the night, and proceeded down the stairs to the lower floor where she was met by her daughter, May. May told her mother that she'd been woken by a cry from Caroline. May said that she called out to her friend upon her cry, telling her to be quiet, but Caroline only moaned in response. She told her mother that she jumped up from her bed and flipped on the lights, and that she thought Caroline was dreaming. But as May approached her, she saw some blood on the white sheets underneath and around her. Mrs. Duncan told May to hurry upstairs and entered the bedroom through the screen door to assess the situation herself, and was terrified to find Caroline deeply gasping for air as if she was having great difficulty breathing. She noticed the blood on the sheets and on Caroline's nightgown. The girl was lying face down. Mrs. Duncan hurried back upstairs to phone a doctor, but the answering service informed her that he wasn't in Port Aransas at the time, so she hung up and dialed Lyman Roberts Hospital in Port Aransas and was advised to wrap Caroline in a blanket and drive her to the emergency room there. Mr. and Mrs. Duncan quickly dressed and returned to the room where Caroline had been left alone, and as Mrs. Duncan prepared to wrap 14-year-old Caroline in the blanket, as the nurse at the hospital had advised, she saw that the bed underneath the girl was soaked in blood. Caroline had what appeared to be a puncture wound on her chest. She noticed, too, that Caroline was gone. There was no pulse, no breathing. Mr. Duncan sprinted back upstairs and telephoned police. Word of what happened spread around Port Aransas fast. A teenage worker at the local movie theater told reporters that the slaying of Caroline Hart was all the girls talked about. The community hadn't been worried about locked doors so much before young Caroline's tragic and appalling murder. Some residents didn't even have locks on their doors at all. But paranoia grew, and doors were most certainly locked after. There was no lock on the door to the room where the two 14-year-old girls had slept on the lower level of the Duncan vacation home. Nueces County Sheriff John Mitchell gathered a team of 8 investigators to work the case. Mae Duncan was, of course, among the first interviewed by police, but they were sure almost immediately that she hadn't killed her friend. Robbery was quickly ruled out as a motive, as nothing had been taken from the room where Caroline and May slept. May said that when she heard Caroline's cry that woke her and heard her moan, which prompted her to turn on the lights, that she saw no one there. No shadows, no movement. No murder weapon was found on the scene or anywhere near. No fingerprints were found on the scene, either. And though investigators tried, a motive could not be determined or even immediately theorized. There's no rhyme or reason to it, Sheriff Mitchell told the press. Caroline's blood stained about 1 foot diameter of the white sheets on which she'd laid. Smaller splotches of blood were found on the sheets as well. And a few drops of Caroline's blood were found on the floor, as if they'd dripped from the murder weapon. The rest of the room, including all the girls' belongings, appeared to have been completely undisturbed. Police searched the entirety of the surrounding area, the neighborhood, the beach and sand dunes, brush, roads, and ditches were scoured. The search was described as intensive. But since law enforcement determined that, at that point, a roadblock stopping traffic from the island to the mainland couldn't be set up in time to check vehicles, it wasn't ordered. They had no idea who they were looking for, anyway. Medical examiner James Sharp took x-rays of Caroline. She'd been stabbed through her 4th rib into her heart. He theorized that the murderer was, quote, a very strong person because the instrument used, he said, was a blunt object with an approximate diameter of a half inch, possibly a pipe or steel rod. Sharp, along with the Justice of the Peace, concluded that no autopsy would be necessary because the fatal wound was obvious. Funeral services were held for Caroline at the Georgian Chapel of the Porter Loring Mortuary in San Antonio on Friday, July 25, 1969. Over 450 people packed the young teenager's funeral services. Caroline Louise Hart was buried the following day, Saturday, July 26, 1969, at Sunset Memorial Park. The Nueces County Justice of the Peace, though, changed his mind and ordered that Caroline's body be exhumed and an autopsy performed. She was exhumed on August 5, 1969, only 10 days after she was buried. An autopsy was performed by the San Antonio medical examiner, who determined that the murder weapon was, actually, a single-edged knife. Since May and Caroline were thought to have had no boyfriends on the island, or none back home for that matter, that line of police investigation was all but immediately considered a dead end. Nueces County Sheriff's Department investigators scrambled to find who was responsible for the cowardly slaying of Caroline, and it is unclear why, exactly, they chose who they did to interview in most cases. They questioned drifters, surfers, maintenance workers, a paperboy, even a reported suspicious man with binoculars who'd been seen around and turned out to be nothing more than a birdwatcher. A probated burglar known as Freddy Flashlight was brought in by police in San Antonio and questioned, but it was a stretch to say the least. And when Freddy offered to take a lie detector test to prove he wasn't involved, they dropped him as a person of interest. A local Navy man's son was questioned in Florida. Police questioned five boys who were reported to have been circling the house the night Caroline was slain. No arrests were made, of course, and it wasn't explained exactly what is meant by circling the house. Investigators did get around to shaking down the usual suspects as well. Individuals with known drug connections, obscene telephone callers, and window peepers. Sex offenders were questioned, of course, although no signs or evidence of a sexual assault against Caroline were found. In fact, sexual assault wasn't even attempted, and not a motive at all. None of the usual suspects panned out. Houston Harrison Hart Jr. didn't waste any time hiring private investigators to handle his beloved daughter's case, which is presumably why an exhumation and autopsy of Caroline's body was ultimately ordered. A reward, too, was quickly established by Mr. Hart, with a major contribution from the Duncan family, who felt some responsibility for the 14-year-old's death since it happened at their vacation home. $20,000, the equivalent of around $140,000 in today's money, was offered for information that would lead to the arrest and conviction of the individual or individuals responsible for the slaying of Caroline Louise Hart. Tips were filtered through the Stanley Smith Detective Agency with a guarantee of secrecy and anonymity for individuals who desired such as a requirement for their information. As per the standard line of investigation during this period, persons of interest were cleared left and right at the behest of a machine, the polygraph. A dock worker and service station attendant being among those who were given the test. Investigators chased down a tip in Rockport, where a man had been stealing women's clothing and shredding panties with a knife, but the lead went nowhere. 3 weeks after Caroline was murdered, a lead was called into police about a bloody knife spotted in the back seat of a car with Michigan plates. The car was found, and the blood wasn't human, but belonged to a fish. While working on a car in an auto shop, a mechanic spotted newspaper clippings about Caroline's slaying in the back seat of a Buick he was repairing. He alerted law enforcement, but it too was a dead end. The Buick belonged to an individual whose daughter knew Caroline and was clipping articles about her for her own interest in the case. The most interesting person of interest, seemingly, was a 23-year-old man who came to the attention of sheriff's office investigators. An informant told police that this man had been offering friends money if they could provide him with a woman who would have sex with him. The informant reported that he was strange, dancing alone while singing to himself, and, most strikingly, the man had scratch marks on his right arm that he couldn't explain, and he was unable to provide an account of his whereabouts the day of Caroline's murder. Since the man's lawyer refused police's request that he take a polygraph test, and because he had no criminal record at all, police had to let him go. Investigators became so desperate for answers, they even entertained the idea, if even for a brief moment, that Caroline's murder was tied to the Manson family murders. May Duncan never got over the senseless and terrifying tragedy that befell her dear friend Caroline Hart on July 24, 1969. Her husband, Skip Doty, told a reporter in 2009 that she suffered deep, lifelong depression and that he and May's decision to never have children was most likely a result of the trauma that Caroline's slaying caused. Trauma that was also the result of May's feelings that, In the eyes of police and those familiar with Caroline's murder, she was still considered a suspect. Houston Hart, Caroline's father, felt that May couldn't accept that the Hart family didn't think she had anything to do with her slaying. Skip told a reporter that he did his best to keep seemingly common household tools that his wife might use to harm herself out of their home, or at least not maintained as they should be, such as letting knives go dull. And although he would not keep a firearm in the home, May purchased a gun without Skip's knowledge. May Duncan Doty committed suicide by gun in the couple's backyard orchard in 2006. Law enforcement have remained baffled about the murder of Caroline Louise Hart for almost 50 years. Though the case has been taken up by new detectives in the years since, no arrests have ever been made. Fresh investigators have reviewed the scant stack of files, and no new leads have ever come their way. Still, the Nueces County Sheriff's Office said they hold out hope that the perpetrator told someone, and that someone will eventually talk, or, perhaps, the killer will attempt to unburden himself of the senseless murder of a 14-year-old girl and confess. Caroline's Uncle Edward was the individual tasked with telling his brother the unimaginable news back in July of 1969. Houston Hart told a reporter in 2009, quote, "Sometimes, as we walked around in shock, I remember thinking to myself, this is a crime that will never be solved. And I was right about that." If you have any information on the murder of Caroline Louise Hart, please contact the Texas Crime Stoppers tip line at 1-800-252-8477. The Corpus Christi Caller Times, the San Antonio Express, and the Austin Statesman were used as source material for this episode. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Another great way to support the show is to leave a rating and review on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to the show. It helps guide more folks our way. And if you're interested in all things true crime, check out our go-to spot on the web, thetruecrimefiles.com. There you'll find always well-presented cases, many unknown or ignored by the media, as well as book reviews, podcast reviews, and guest posts. TheTrueCrimeFiles.com is an amazing resource for learning about cases you might not be aware of otherwise. Check it out. Thanks for listening, y'all.